HBBroadcraft.com. We were loading bananas into the Claire Dodge at Puerto Pobre when a feverish little fellow came aboard. Everyone stepped aside to let him pass, even the soldiers who guard the port with nickel-plated Remington rifles and who go barefoot but wear polished leather leggings. They stood back from him because they believed that he was afflicted of God, mad, harmless but dangerous, and best left alone. All the time the naphtha flares were hissing, and from the hold came the reverberation of the roaring voice of the foreman of the gang down below, crying, "Fruta, fruta, fruta." The leader of the dock gang bellowed the same cry, throwing down stem after stem of brilliant green bananas. Out of one stem of bananas ran a hairy gray spider, which frightened the crew and broke the banana chain, until a Nicaraguan boy, with a laugh, killed it with his foot. "It was harmless," he said. It was about then that the madman came aboard, unhindered, and asked me, "Bound for where?" He spoke quietly and in a carefully modulated voice, but there was a certain blank, lost look in his eyes that suggested to me that I keep within ducking distance of his restless hands, which, now that I think of them, put me in mind of that gray, hairy, bird-eating spider. "Mobile, Alabama," I said. "Take me along," he asked.
"Oh, me too, me too. Wait, this is the booze cruise, right?"
"You know, I'm not sure. Let me check. Are people staggering even though the ship is still docked? Yes."
"Uh-huh, yeah."
"Is there a woman sitting on a stairwell crying? Yes."
"Okay."
"Are there puddles of vomit containing lots of shrimp everywhere? Yes." "It is a booze cruise."
"Woohoo! I'm in. Let's do it."
"Yes, you're in. I'm in. And our listeners are all in on this journey now, too, whether they like it or not." Welcome to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, Booze Cruise Edition. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey, and I'm already a little tipsy here at HP Podcraft and Patreon. And the theme of this cruise is Men Without Bones by Gerald Kirsch. You just heard some paragraphs in the opening. Who was that reader?
Why, that was Kyle Akers making his debut. Kyle is a voice actor from Kansas City, Missouri, and a friend of the show.
Oh.
He's been contributing to the No Sleep podcast in season 2 and has read for Pseudopod, Escape Pod, and Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. He also produces and performs in his own improv podcast called The Counselor.
Oh.
Check that out. Kyle toured the country as a professional musician, singing and playing bass guitar for the electro-pop band Antennas Up, which I went and checked out. They're really good. They kind of remind me of Two Door Cinema Club or Capital Cities.
Oh, right, yeah.
I know bands hate to be compared to each other, so hopefully that doesn't offend Kyle, but that means I like it. I like the group. Kyle continues to perform with Kansas City cover band The Magnetics, so if you're in the KC area, please check them out. So Gerald Kirsch, listeners seem pretty excited about this author. This particular story was actually recommended to us by three different people on separate occasions. This is the first thing I've read by him, I think. I wasn't familiar with any of his other work, but what do we know about Gerald?
Gerald Kirsch was born in 1911, and he started his writing at the ripe old age of 8, which I thought was like, not a big deal. My kid has like 10 issues of his comic book that he's written and drawn, and he's 7, so I'm not impressed.
Forget all that stuff I said back on the Graveyard Rats episode. If you're not established before you hit double digits, you suck. I remember a couple of years ago, Jacob Tremblay, the child actor, was getting a lot of buzz for that movie Room. I don't know if you saw it.
Yeah, I don't know.
He's a little kid who had to grow up in this one room. Brie Larson was in it as well. Much deserved. The kid was great. Mm-hmm. But I was reading this New York Times article about it, and the article said, "Tremblay, a young-looking 9, has been generating serious Oscar attention." And I stopped. I was like, what is wrong with this writer? Young-looking 9? Like, as opposed to what? Man, once these kids reach 9, they really crack. I can't hire a 9-year-old that looks his age. It'll be a disaster. And I know the writer probably meant to say, you know, Tremblay could play younger than his actual age, but that's not the way it came off. Anyway.
No.
I assume Kirsch wasn't making a living writing at 8.
No, God, no. He was a starving artist type for most of his life. He had lots of different jobs. He was a cinema manager, a bodyguard, a debt collector, fish and chips cook, traveling salesman, French teacher, and all-in wrestler. And I had to look up what an all-in wrestler was.
Yeah.
It's kind of no rules, start of professional wrestling in the UK.
Oh, cool. Well, he was from the UK. He was born in Teddington-on-Thames. And I did look up his record as a wrestler. He had 3 bouts, 1 win, 1 loss, and 1 draw.
Mm.
He experienced all wrestling outcomes and then threw in the shorts, I guess. I got that from Harlan Ellison's website. And there was a lot more on there in terms of biography.
Oh.
Kirsch was one of Ellison's favorite writers, so he had a lot to say about him. Ellison wrote, "Kirsch was always getting into fights of one sort or another. One time, in 1931, a man tried to liquidate him with a 6-penny hatchet.
Whoa.
Kirsch sidestepped, escaped with a small gash on his forehead and a bit of a concussion, retaliated with a little marble top table, and won on a technical knockout.
Whoa.
However, the man succeeded in jolting a nerve, which for more than 15 years consistently gave Kirsch a sore head and kept him awake nights.
Oh, God.
He bore other trophies, a knife wound in his left wrist, and tooth marks on the knuckles of his right hand.
Damn.
Which is the coolest scar I've ever heard of.
Yeah, it's pretty badass.
Ever.
His first book, Jews Without Jehovah, was published in 1934. It was autobiographical and about him growing up poor and Jewish. But since he didn't cover up the names as well as he should have, he got sued for libel by some of his family members, and the book was pulled.
Oh, geez.
He wrote Night in the City in 1938, which got made into not one, but two movies.
Yes, and a very typical Hollywood story as well. When Kirsch sold the film rights to Night and the City for $40,000, all the important aspects of the book were removed from the script. So he joked that he was the highest paid writer in history because they paid him $10,000 a word for the title. That eventually became the film starring Richard Widmark in 1950. The second one has De Niro in it.
Yeah.
And I think it came out in 92. Can't speak for how close that one is to the book either, but I don't think too close. As well as the novels, Kirsch was a prolific writer of short stories for magazines like Courier and John O. London's Weekly, and was well known in Fleet Street. Kirsch wrote many crime-oriented short stories, but the best remembered of his works were his series of tall stories about Karmazin, the greatest criminal the world has ever seen, or its greatest liar. The format involved Kirsch himself talking to this old rogue in various cafes and bars around London. As Karmazin told his tales of robbery, blackmail, deceit, and murder, he would offhandedly cage cigarettes off Kirsch or surreptitiously fill his pockets with sachets of sugar. So maybe just a low-rent con, you know, who's telling stories so you don't notice the thievery. But it sounds pretty funny. Sounds like some cool stuff.
Kirsch was drafted into the army for World War II and ended up in the Army Film Unit.
Apparently he was a good shot too. It says he won 100 cigarettes in the company shoot. There seems to be a lot of economy of cigarettes surrounding this guy in the Karmazin stories and this. But Kirsch wrote At Night while in the military, and check this out. He got a manuscript half finished, then he took his first leave during the London Blitz.
Oh.
Both he and the manuscript were buried alive by a bomb.
Oh my God.
Kirsch survived, but the manuscript didn't. After the bomb, Kirsch's knees kept locking, so he had a cartilage removed, a piece of cartilage, which he kept for good luck, and later swapped with an American for a Zippo lighter. Again, the cigarette economy, but who was this American that wanted cartilage? How is that a good deal? See here, this lighter is very important to me, and I won't part with it. Wait, is that knee cartilage? Now you got me over a barrel. Maybe it was Private Frankenstein.
Oh.
Could be.
That knee injury got Kirsch transferred to the War Office, where they asked him to write a pamphlet about infantry training. But they rejected his efforts, so he finished the manuscript himself and called it They Died With Their Boots Clean, a story of how a bunch of raw recruits were immersed in basic training before being hammered into soldiers. It was one of the best-selling books of the war.
Ah.
That was Kirsch's first big success.
Take that, War Office.
It seems like he deserted the army when in France and found out that a lot of his family there had been sent to the extermination camps.
An American colonel got Kirsch accredited as an American war correspondent. I think he had a uniform and everything.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably Private Frankenstein that helped him out with that. And he flew to France as a deserter, which is crazy because France was the battlefront. So that's a weird thing for a deserter to do. But I think he just believed in the war effort, but couldn't do well in the structured military. It was just a bad place for him to be.
Wow.
So anyway, he was in France during the liberation of Paris. And while he was there, he found family still living. He stole food from the army mess to give it to them. But as you say, he discovered that a few members had disappeared. Two of them, he figured out, had been taken away in one of the death trains.
So after the war, he continued to write. He made a good living at it for a while. He went back to England and somehow got away with the desertion. I'm not exactly sure how that happened.
Didn't get busted for it.
Yeah. He wrote about Bergen-Belsen concentration camp and co-wrote the screenplay to The True Glory, a documentary film that won an Oscar.
Yes, so take that, Jacob Tremblay. Despite all that buzz for Room, Tremblay didn't even get nominated. Kirsch won something.
In your face, kid.
Maybe you should get a better skincare regimen, Tremblay.
So Kirsch visited America regularly and managed to crack prestigious and high-paying magazines like the Saturday Evening Post, Esquire, Playboy, and Collier's. If Kirsch is remembered for anything, it is for his short stories.
Yeah, Warren Ellis says they are reminiscent of Guy de Maupassant or H.G. Wells in that Kirsch wrote equally well in every genre. His storytelling often blurs the line between fact and fiction. This was funny to me. One story in the Saturday Evening Post about a pilot who flies so fast he goes back in time, regresses to a baby, then crashes, was actually broadcast as literal news by a radio station.
Oh, no.
Another story where it is explained that the Mona Lisa kept her mouth shut because she has bad teeth is often quoted as fact.
Right.
To this day,
yeah.
I've heard that.
I've heard that one, yeah.
So I think he's the one that that planted that seed.
Wow.
And I also wonder if that pilot story from the radio was ever quoted as fact. Like, listen, friend, I wouldn't fly on that Concorde if I were you. If it goes too fast, you might turn into a baby. Be careful.
Oh, golly.
Maybe that's why Jacob Tremblay's such a young-looking nine. His parents put him in a centrifuge every night to keep him from aging. You got to go fast, kid.
You got to be careful, Pfeiffer. You're going to waste all your Jacob Tremblay material in one episode.
Never. I got a lot of jokes about Jacob Tremblay.
So Kirsch continued to be successful until the 1950s when he got sick and got in trouble for not paying his taxes.
Tax evasion. Which, if I were Gerald Kirsch, I would have gone to an accountant just so I could say, oh, you want to see my receipts, huh? Then I'd hold up the fist with the tooth marks. I got a receipt here for a knuckle sandwich. Now cook the books, kid. He's British, so I don't know why he's talking that way. According to Harlan Ellis's bio, traveling the world in search of a home and a tax haven, Kirsch bought a $20,000 house in Barbados, but it was burnt down.
Oh,
it was bad luck.
Can't win this guy.
Yeah, and so he had no insurance on it apparently either. So he became a Canadian resident for 5 years and then decided on American citizenship. From 1950, he suffered from infections, diseased tissue, and God knows what else. Still, he continued to write in all genres. His only science fiction novel is The Great Wash, published as Secret Masters in the U.S., which pivots on the plans of a group of scientists who want to take over the world by melting the polar ice caps, hence flooding most of the world's population.
Whoa.
I read that synopsis. I was like, man, he misjudged who would be causing that. It's not the scientists.
Always in financial difficulty, his lodgings became more shabby. Credit was no longer extended. His acrimonious divorce from his second wife in 1955 left him with even more debts and responsibilities. But he continued to write all the way up to his death. And he died on November 5th, 1968.
Ellis concludes in his biography, I'm doing everything in my power to get Kirsch's works back in print. I think the audience is there. During my research, I have learned there is a sizable number of people who think that they are the only ones who read Kirsch. You can always spot a Kirsch reader. They have this inner light, this twinkle in their eye that says, if you only knew what I know. They know about Kirsch. It's their secret. The world is foolish and chooses to ignore him. Bad luck for the world. Good luck for us.
Aww.
I say let's twinkle up some eyes, dude.
Yep.
Let's talk about Men Without Bones.
All right. Yes, Men Without Bones was first published in 1955 in the UK and published in 1962 in the US. The story begins with an unnamed narrator who's on a boat that is in Puerto Pobre, Puerto Rico, soon to depart for Mobile, Alabama. This little force of nature guy shows up on the boat and demands to know where the ship is going. The narrator tells him, and this guy wants a ride.
And also asks for some rum, because as we established, this is a booze cruise.
Yeah.
He really does ask for rum, I think, to steady his nerves.
Yes. The little guy is acting a bit odd, but then he says something that always puts my mind at ease. I'm not crazy. Because no crazy person has ever said that.
And then he goes on to say, I just have a little fever, nothing more. Dengue fever, jungle fever, rat bite fever, feverish country this. And I haven't even heard of rat bite fever until like a few weeks ago.
Yeah, I know.
Synchronicity, man.
So the little guy introduces himself as Goodbody, doctor of science. But the narrator hasn't heard of him. So Goodbody says he was the assistant to Professor Yoward. That rings a bell to the narrator. And he knows that Yoward had an expedition up the Amur River and was lost while on it.
Goodbody is this character's name, and that's about as punny as a name can be considering the story is called Men Without Bones.
Right.
So it's about bodies, you know.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, I was thinking of like not since Dr. Holly Goodhead and the James Bond movies has there been a more obvious name choice, but I like it.
So Goodbody does seem to be suffering from a fever and shakes as he brings the rum to his lips that the narrator has generously shared with him. He begs the narrator to smuggle him out of the country, but the narrator's like, why don't you just get out legally? Goodbody is an American citizen. It shouldn't be a problem, but Goodbody wants out now. He's afraid. He's afraid of the men without bones.
Hmm.
Now, that sounds ridiculous, but this does creep the narrator out, and he wants to know more.
Men without bones, he said, and there was something in his voice that stirred the hairs on the back of my neck. Little fat men without bones. So the narrator gives him a little quinine and lets him shake and shiver down a bit. And then he asks, what men without bones?
So Goodbody changes his tune a bit and says that you shouldn't really be afraid of them. They're easy to kill. You can just step on them or stab them with a stick. They're like jelly. But they do inspire an intense nausea, a disgust that overwhelms and paralyzes. He says he saw a jaguar freeze as these things clung to it and then ate it alive.
That's not a good example of why I shouldn't be afraid of them.
Exactly. I thought the same thing.
I am much weaker than a jaguar.
So good buddy suggests that maybe these men without bones secrete some kind of odor or something, and then he just starts crying. Oh, nightmare, nightmare, nightmare! To think the depths of which a noble creature could be degraded by hunger. Horrible, horrible! The narrator tries to clarify, asking if these things are some kind of anthropod from the source of the river, maybe, but Goodbody says, no, 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 no. They are men. And he tells how the whole expedition was lost. All the men were killed except for Goodbody and Professor Yaward. They lost most of their supplies and tools as well.
They met with all kinds of misadventures along the way, and it's just the two of them left.
They were helped by some native people who Yaward bribed into carrying their remaining stuff and guided them to a spot that they were looking for. Now, there are some local folk tales about a race of gods that came down from the sky in a great flame when the world was young.
That's why Professor Yaward and the crew even went out there, because all science starts with a guess, a rumor, an old wives' tale. And the object of Professor Yoward's expedition was to investigate a series of Indian folk tales that tallied. You know, they were enough of them by enough people that he thought there must be some kernel of truth.
Yaward was able to track the location of the origin of this legend, but the natives won't go to that place. They have no name for it. They just call it the Bad Place. The Indians took them to the edge of the Bad Place and dropped them off. No matter what was offered, they would not continue. One of them drew a picture in the sand. It was an oval-bodied creature with four limbs. And then they spit on the ground and they rub it out with their foot. The explorers asked them, are we supposed to beware of spiders? Is this a crab? What is this? What are you trying to show us?
It was a bad game of Pictionary. They couldn't explain it.
Yeah, they just give up. So Yaward and Goodbody had to trek 30 miles of jungle, covering only a quarter a mile a day. And I was like, wait a minute, that's 4 months.
Yeah.
It can't be out in the jungle for 4 months with just like a couple bags that you can carry.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it certainly doesn't sound like it was a pleasant journey, but yeah, 4 months of stretching it. Maybe it was, and they just ate bugs and leaves and things. I don't know.
Maybe they know how to survive out in the jungle. Anyway, they say that the jungle was rotten and full of diseases. They finally reached the plateau they were searching for. They climbed up it and saw something that looked like a great machine of some kind. It was pear-shaped and at least 1,000 feet long and about 600 feet wide at its widest part. They weren't sure what kind of metal it was made out of, but the impact of this thing made a huge valley at the top of this plateau. This proves not only was there alien life, but it had been to Earth ages ago. They got super excited and they started looking around, but everything they touched just turned to dust. So after some more searching, they found this very hard metal circular plate, and they spent the day cleaning it off and examining it. Yaward figured out that it was some kind of star map and that it charts a course from Mars to Earth. Yaward showed how they came to Earth via the moon and then they crashed in the jungle. It could have happened thousands, maybe even millions of years ago, that maybe this ship was buried at one point, but only recently surfaced due to volcanic activity.
Some ancient alien stuff, you know, rising up from prehistoric times. Very Lovecraftian. And when I got here in the story, I started understanding, aside from the creepy idea of men without bones, why this was recommended so often.
So that night, they built a fire and Yaward went to sleep right away, but Goodbody stayed up to watch out. But he thought, for what? There are no jaguars or snakes up here, not on this high plateau. But he was still afraid for some reason. As he's sitting there, Goodbody dozed off and woke up noticing that the fire was almost out. And he saw reflective eyes outside of the ring of fire. But then there was this odor, terrible and unlike anything he'd ever smelled before. He says, fear has its smell, as any animal trainer will tell you. Sickness has its smell. Ask any nurse. These smells compel healthy animals to fight or to run away. This was a combination of the two, plus a stink of vegetation gone bad.
At first, he thought maybe it was a jaguar out there, and he pulled up his rifle, but there were a lot of eyes, a lot of them, around the fire that he was seeing, not just one set.
So Goodbody fired his gun at the eyes, and then they all disappeared. The morning came soon, and he went to go check out if he had hit anything, and he did. It was one of these creatures. It was dead, shot between the eyes.
It was gray and in texture tough and gelatinous. Yet in form, externally, it was not unlike a human being. It had eyes, and there were either vestiges or rudiments of a head and neck and a kind of limbs.
He was afraid of it, but Yaward told him to, you know, suck it up and get his scientist pants on. Don't be such a fraidy cat.
It's explicit that Yaward kept his distance when Goodbody was examining this thing, so I think that was a lot of talk. Yaward ordered him to go examine it, and Goodbody did.
Microscopes and other delicate instruments had been lost with the canoes. I worked with a knife and forceps and found nothing. A kind of digestive system enclosed in a very tough jelly. A rudimentary nervous system and a brain about the size of a walnut. The entire creature stretched out measured 4 feet. In a laboratory, I could tell you, perhaps, something about it, with an assistant or two to keep me company. As it was, I did what I could with a hunting knife and forceps, without dyes or microscope, swallowing my nausea. It was a nauseating thing, memorizing what I found. But as the sun rose higher, the thing liquefied, melted, until by 9 o'clock, there was nothing but a glutinous gray puddle, with 2 green eyes swimming in it. And these eyes, I see them now, burst with a thick pop, making a detestable sticky ripple in that puddle of corruption.
It's that thick pop that's really terrible.
Yeah.
It's a puddle of a body, a little like the ending of Cool Air or the novel of The White Powder by Arthur Machen, which, by the way, we've never covered, but we're finally going to be covering this year. Yeah. You folks have been asking about that lately, but it's a little similar to that story.
Also, Puddle of Corruption was my college band.
Love me some Puddle of Corruption.
He did some great stuff. This really freaked out Goodbody, but Yawar told him to be a detached man of science and to just get on with it. God knows we are not here for the good of our health. Science, man, science! Not a day passes, but some doctor pokes his fingers in fouler things than that.
And that's the A to Z of being a scientist. Don't give me this studying and experimenting and methodologies. Sticking your fingers in foul things, that's the stuff. I'll be way back here observing, so get on with it.
Yaward is still fixated on this plate, and that is where he is spending all of his energy. Goodbody went out and examined the animal life around the spot, and then he talks about a sloth. Oh, it's very slow, but very tough. It's got tough hide, coarse hair. Even jaguars don't mess with it just because it's too hard for them to eat. But on one of Goodbody's expeditions around this area, these men without bones, they came pouring up the tree and wrapped around a sloth. There was that horrible smell again, and the creatures, they didn't bite the sloth, they sucked it. And as they sucked, their color changed from gray to pink to brown.
By the way, Bite the Sloth, wasn't that Puddle of Corruption's first album? Your vocals on that were amazing.
Yeah, thanks. I look back on it now, and I think I've grown as an artist a lot, but it's got merit still.
Yeah.
Anyway, Goodbody explains that these things are afraid of us, that there's some kind of race memory where we fear them and they fear us.
Race Memory was a pretty disappointing art album from Puddle of Corruption. Don't see that in print much anymore.
No, it was a short run. It was like 500 copies. That was.
It was so misinterpreted.
Yeah.
Goodbody explains, when they became aware of my presence, they, I was going to say ran away. They slid away, dissolved into the shadows that kept dancing and dancing and dancing under the trees. Thought that was really good, terrifying writing.
When he saw all this, he got creeped out and he ran back to the camp. When he got back, Yaward, the professor, was lancing his ankle and he had a tourniquet around his leg. There was a dead snake right next to him. Yaward told Goodbody that he was bitten by the now dead snake. Unfortunately, being the biologist, Goodbody informs him that that is a venomous snake and its bite is quite fatal. Yaward says, "Whatever happens, my dear fellow, take this and get back." So Yaward gave him the semicircle of metal that he had been trying to decipher and figure out what it was, the alien artifact. And then he died 2 hours later. Goodbody covered the body in rocks so that the men without bones would not get to it.
Couldn't they slither in through the cracks in the rocks, I was thinking?
Well, it depends on how tightly packed these rocks are.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Then Goodbody took off, freaked out and scared. He kept ditching supplies to move faster. First his pack, then his rifle, then food, then even his machete. Soon, he even gets rid of the alien plate. He ties it to a tree to find later. But then he got all delirious and he made his way back to the Indian territory. He was on the verge of death, but they nursed him back to health. These very kind Indians. It says here, "The women chewed my food for me before they fed me until I was strong again." They gave him a canoe and he went off. His story is over and he asked for more rum. The narrator says, "So these Martians, they had no bones. How could they smelt hard metal? That doesn't make any sense."
"Who said anything about Martians?" cried Dr. Goodbody. "No, no, no. The Martians came here, adapted themselves to new conditions of life. Poor fellows, they changed, sank low, went through a whole new process, a painful process of evolution. What I'm trying to tell you, you fool, is that Yoward and I did not discover Martians. Idiot, don't you see? The boneless things are men. We are Martians."
The end?
Yeah, that's the end of the story.
Huh?
Obviously, that's the end of the story. It's got the italicized... Shocker.
Yeah.
I mean, I do have to ask. It is a killer ending, but how does he know that?
Yeah. What about all the scientific proof that doesn't corroborate that? Like, that all life on Earth is really similar.
Yeah, that's true.
There's nothing like men without bones on the planet, but there are tons of animals that are just like us.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. I don't get it.
Well, it would make sense if, you know, maybe later they discovered that we had some sort of extraterrestrial thing that couldn't have been on this Earth. Maybe if they had, when they saw the technology, reverberated with it somehow, or were able to decipher things they shouldn't have been able to decipher. Like, speaking of race memory, you know, there would be some kind of thing that, but yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
When I read it the first time, nobody spoiled this for me.
Yeah.
I read the last line and I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah.
I didn't think about any of the stuff we're discussing right now. I was just like, oh, that.
I did as well.
Yeah, because you just made an assumption. And then and Goodbody actually says at the beginning, no, these are men. The story title is Men Without Bones.
Yeah.
He makes this assumption, oh, they're Martians. And you're like, so he's right to call him an idiot. You idiot, this whole time I've been telling you these are men.
Yeah.
But then it's saying, we are the Martians. I don't know how he gets to that conclusion.
When I first read it, I thought, oh, that's cool. And when I thought about it, I go, that doesn't make a lick of sense.
But, well, a lot of our listeners like this story. So maybe they're going to hit us with something that we missed.
Maybe I missed something.
We're going to be the ones who are idiots.
I have an open mind.
Our listeners are not the only ones who recommended this story. Our occasional guest, friend of the show, Patton Oswalt, digs it as well.
Oh, right, yeah.
He did this list of 31 horror stories on his website 1 month, quite a while ago, but it's still there. Hmm. And one of the selections, we've covered a bunch of them, actually, but one of the selections is this story. And Patton writes, Gerald Kirsch is another one of those writers who have so many good stories and such great titles. But the problem with Kirsch would be choosing his second best story. The Dancing Doll, The Man Who Sold His Head, that's great. A Game Played in the Twilight, and The Unkillable Man would all be up there.
Oh, wow.
But Kirsch took a trip into the metaphoric jungle as well as outside the margins of space and time for this one. If you're a fan of British gangster films and are as aware of how influential Kirsch's work was on the genre, then this story will confuse and chill you. I know everyone likes Sweets for the Sweet and To Serve Man for their punch-in-the-gut final line twist endings, but I think this one's got them beat.
All right, when I talk to Pat next, I'm going to have to find out what I'm missing on this whole thing.
Well, it's interesting that he says metaphoric jungle, so is this supposed to be allegory of some type? Is there like a whole level I'm missing?
There might be. Listener, if you know something we don't, please inform us. I feel like I'm missing something right
this
now.
This is a short story. I actually had to track it down online, and I'll share the link, but it's from the Wayback Machine, and the layout's not so great, so it's a little difficult to read.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could read the story and tell us why we're stupid, I'd appreciate it. There's a lot of reasons why we're stupid, but specifically why we're stupid about this one, that'd be great. I did like the ending, though. I did enjoy reading the story.
Oh, yeah.
And it certainly thematically fits in with Lovecraft's work, and there's a lot of elements that fit in with Lovecraft's work, not just the ancient alien stuff, but that's this whole revelation of alien heritage, if it is indeed true.
Right.
Everything you thought you were, you aren't.
Yeah.
And this isn't just, you know, your great grandmother did it with a gorilla. You're a Martian. You're from another planet entirely.
Right.
Weirdest episode of Finding Your Roots ever.
So I want to thank Kyle Akers for reading this for us.
Yeah, thanks so much, Kyle. Next month, we're going to be featuring some creatures in our stories, a few recommended directly by old H.P. Lovecraft. We're kicking it off with The Canal by Everil Whirl,
mm-hmm.
a female writer who held her own amongst the boys' club at Weird Tales. She had a lot of stories in that magazine. This one is very popular and has a vampire in it,
ooh,
I believe.
Yeah.
And then The Kill, which a lot of our listeners have recommended over the years. And, you know, I was talking about James Bond earlier. This story, The Kill, was actually written by Ian Fleming's older and I think more handsome brother, Peter Fleming. And you will be happy to know, as it is February, that The Kill is a werewolf tale.
Oh, yeah.
Werewolf History Month still lives, at least in one story, February. We'll also be doing King of the Cats by Stephen Vincent Benet. Keeping with the recent rodent fascination, we'll be doing The Rat by S. Fowler Wright.
Huh?
Although I believe that story concerns the concept of immortality more than it does rat attacks. But again, I haven't read it yet, so we'll see. Could be a rat attack in it.
All that plus our comment shows and bonus content. We're going to talk about Val Lewton's Cat People movies for our $6 subscribers. There's also more original fiction coming your way. Lots of stuff to put in your ears. And it's all made possible by our patrons. And I want to thank some of them.
Yes. And we got a birthday wish from one of them who happened to be the first person on our list. This was a note I got from Cindy McMillan. I'm writing to ask you a very big favor for my fiance, Joe Rasmussen. He is one of your biggest fans. He loves everything H.P. Lovecraft and was thrilled when he discovered your show. It took him a lot of time to catch up because before listening to your shows, he reads/listens to each story.
Mm.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah.
He is turning 40 on December 1st, 2018. And if there was any way for you two to give him a birthday shout out, I would be so grateful. So we were a little belated there. But happy birthday, Joe Rasmussen, and thank you so much for being a patron.
You know, I want to say that I think late birthday wishes and late birthday gifts are awesome. Yeah. Because
that's true.
It extends your birthday. It extends the celebration. Instead of having a birthday, now you have a birth week, a birth month, a birth 2 months.
Yeah, absolutely. And plus, there's a bit of a letdown. Everybody loves you for one day, and then the next day you're back to your old average self.
Yeah.
But if you get the belated stuff,
exactly,
you can recapture that memory. You're right. It makes it last a little longer.
So, Joe, I hope you're having a delightful second birthday month.
Birthday quarter for you, Joe. Joseph Rasmussen.
But I would also like to thank some other people.
Yes.
Aaron Duttill.
I would like to thank Steve Sick.
I'd like to thank Danielle Boucher.
Also thanks to John Rowe.
Tony Siak.
Franklin Smith, thank you.
Thank you to Derek Halkenseth.
Duncan Barnett, thank you so much.
And Jackie Pearson, thank you.
You know what? Happy belated birthday to all of you.
Aww.
I assume you all got older last year.
Yeah.
Everybody has a birthday, so happy birthday. And remember, if you are displeased with the aging that you're doing, just jump in a fast-moving plane. Sooner or later, you'll be an infant again, because that's the way it works.
Thank you, people, for tuning in. I am Chris Lackey.
And I'm Chad Pfeiffer. You've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.